Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room. Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Well, welcome back into the House of Mysteries. Now, I'm Al Warren, and joining me hosting today is Julie Sav.
Hi, guys.
Hey. So, now, another day. Now, today we're back into... I don't know if what we're going to classify this under, true crime, JFK stuff, conspiracy. And we're talking about a book that I found very, very interesting. We have it on our site. Please pick it up if you get a chance. Excellent read. And it's on the Scorzeny papers. And it's the evidence plot to kill JFK. Now, we've got the writer... Major Gannis, Ralph Gannis, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ralph. Hello, Julie.
Hi.
So, if I can call you Ralph.
No, absolutely. Or Major.
Or Major, okay.
Either way.
How did you yourself get into writing this book, first of all? Let's talk about your history and how the book came into being in existence.
Okay, that's... A very simple question and a good one. For years, I've loved history. I've actually written several books on Jesse James, the outlaw Jesse James. I was one time rather noted for my works on Jesse. But I'm also a military historian, and a few years ago, there was made available to the public through an auction the papers of Otto Scorzeny. He was Hitler's top commando in World War II. And I took note of the auction. I thought, well, this may be a real opportunity. As a military man, I knew a lot about Scorzeny. He was a very well-known commando from World War II and highly respected not only by his own people but by the adversaries as well. Winston Churchill and the Americans also feared him. He was a very efficient special forces operator. So we had a high regard for him during the war, but after the war, he was a great mystery. He had been declared not guilty by the Nuremberg trials. He wasn't, although he was an SS officer, he was not involved with the concentration camps. He was a Waffen SS, meaning armed SS. He was a soldier, and he performed commando missions. But he was declared not guilty by the Nuremberg trials. He was tried for not war crimes, but... violations of the laws of war. But after the war, although he was held for a short time, he escaped, or so-called escaped, and then became somewhat of a mystery man. He was a great enigma. He surfaced in Spain in 1950 and died in 1975. He was basically a Madrid businessman and became very wealthy, but there was a lot of speculation about what he was doing after the war. Was he involved in running the Nazi rat lines, the Odessa, as it's been called. So when I saw that his papers were coming up for sale, I thought, well, here's an opportunity to secure his papers and maybe solve the enigma of his post-war life. So So that was the original intent. I wanted, as a military historian and military man, to study these papers and perhaps glean something new about his military activity, but also his post-war life. And in that process is where I received the surprise of what the papers did hold. And that was the evidence for covert activity, involvement with Western intelligence and Western operations, and also the Kennedy assassination.
Wow. So that was quite a discovery finding this. What was your thought about JFK and the assassination before you came across the papers?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I never thought much about it. I never considered myself a JFK history enthusiast or anything of that matter. I guess I was familiar with the basic facts, somewhat familiar with the Warren Commission findings and the controversy. You know, like many people, I probably watched a lot of the specials. It is intriguing. For me, personally, as far as JFK, I've always had a connection with him because my birthday is May 29th and his birthday is May 29th, so I had that connection. I was always cognizant of that birthday connection, and I always considered him a great president and still do. But as far as, believe me, when I bought the Skorzeny papers, the farthest thing from my mind was the JFK assassination.
Right. So that was a total surprise. So let's talk about the primary character there, Skorzeny. What did you find out about him as what he was doing after the war?
Well, it's a multifaceted question, but I'll try to keep it simple. The papers, and it all derives from the papers. The papers are business papers. It's not a diary as such. There is intimate correspondence in there, but very little. Mostly what the papers are communications between Skorzeny and his wife, Elsa, over a long period of time, from basically right after the war, 1945, all the way to his death in 1975, and some of the business dealings that they are involved with in business operations. But these papers are in multiple languages. Some of them were in German, English, Portuguese, Spanish, French, and others. So I had to get a lot of it translated. But there was enough in English when I first got them for me to realize, especially with my background, that Skorzeny was an asset of the United States intelligence services and also of other Western intelligence, and that he was an active participant in covert and clandestine activity. That became apparent rather quickly when I examined the papers. And you have to understand that the auction house had looked at the papers and did not see it, but I did see it. And like I said, almost immediately. The part about his connection to the Dallas affair came later as I began to transcribe the documents, get them translated, and understand the relationships that are revealed, the business relationships and personal relationships that are revealed in the papers. It surfaced. So there was a point of discovery, if you will, along the way where I realized, you know, I either have the answer to Dallas or I have the key that will unlock the answer. I knew it was one of those two.
So now let's people know what Skorzeny was. Like, who was he before the end of the war?
Okay, Skorzeny started out as a really an obscure officer. He was he's Austrian born. He was born in Austria, 1908. He was in the Nazi Party early on in Austria and was in the SS. The General SS. In other words, he was a pretty much active in the Nazi Party in Austria prior to the war. When the war broke out, he actually attempted to join the Luftwaffe, or the German Air Force. But he was turned down. He was a little bit too old for that, so he was turned down, and he went into the Waffen-SS, or the Armed SS, which is the combat force of the SS, not the concentration guards, but the actual combat forces. And he was in an artillery unit as a rather mundane motor officer. He did go to the Eastern Front, fought the Russians, and it was in battle. He got wounded. He was, by all accounts, a brave man and was serving on the front. He did have some wounds and also some illnesses that required his recovery in Berlin. And it was at that point where he was noticed by the higher-ups in the Nazi Party. And how that came about is the Nazis were considering creating commando-like forces. Hitler actually admired the British commando groups, the SAS and the British SOE commandos, and he wanted to create their own capability. And Skorzeny had written a paper about it and submitted it through channels. It got people's attention, and he was offered the job of leading what became the Third Reich Special Forces, and he did a great job at it. And so one of his well-known operations early on, right after he took over, was the rescue of Benito Mussolini in Italy. Mussolini had been arrested by his own people and was going to be turned over to the Allies. They had placed him in seclusion and in basically a prisoner at Gran Sasso, a high mountaintop retreat in Italy. Skorzeny was tasked personally by Hitler to find Mussolini and rescue him, and that's exactly what he did. It's called the Gran Sasso Raid, September of 1943. Skorzeny and a group of German paratroopers, Luftwaffe paratroopers, landed in gliders and assaulted this mountain in a brilliant, even to this day, it's considered one of the classic military raids of all time. And they landed and secured Benito Mussolini and then flew him off the mountain. But this was just one operation that Skorzeny was in. He did several operations of this magnitude that were really impressive. And it didn't change the outcome of the war for Germany, but it did left a lasting impact on special operations.
Ralph, may I ask a question?
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. You're clearly so passionate about your history, and you've, you know, for somebody who's obviously you're used to researching for your previous books, and you've gone out and you've bought these papers. How long was it when you were sifting through these papers that you suddenly thought, actually, these are so important to history? Did you have to inform anybody that these were in your hands? What was that process like for you?
That's an excellent question. When I first got the papers, obviously I was very excited. I mean, it's rare. I don't care who you're dealing with, especially if you have a famous historical figure like Skorzeny. When you have primary source that's never been exploited, I mean, these papers literally came from the wife, Elsa, through a Spanish family. They had never been seen by the public or anyone else, never been evaluated. So I was excited at that level, but I did realize early on he was an intelligence asset working for the United States government, and I'll just be point blank, the CIA. And this was involving securing scientists for Operation Paperclip. There are documents within the archive that clearly show that he was locating ballistic experts for our rocket program, the Wernher von Braun project. I found those quickly. So I knew he was doing that right off the bat. And that would have been a tremendous story unto itself. But then as I continued, I began to notice the Dallas business links that he had. And then as I examined those people and those links, I realized that they are, in fact, also intelligence and operational assets of the government, of the United States government. So I knew that his network extended into Dallas, and then continuing the research, it became apparent that the operational links and the people that he was involved with were the same ones that were in the stories of the JFK assassination. In fact, the overlap was quite shocking. Now, when I realized this, there was a point of discovery when I was by myself and did realize that. And it was a sobering moment, I'll just say that, okay? So I knew I had evidence. I never developed a theory about what happened in Dallas. I have evidence of what happened in Dallas. and I decided to write about it simply because the story was highly complex, and I thought I would take it to the people.
How did that affect your own military position and career? Because all of a sudden, practicing military, member of the military personnel has had these documents landed that are now given very clear evidence into something that was so, horrifically conducted. How's that impacted right. upon yourself?
Well, I thought, I am a retired Air Force officer and an intelligence officer, so I'm still under oath, obviously. So I did consider my responsibilities, but there was two major pieces to that. First, the papers were privately owned papers. They're not government declassified documents, or, there was no classification there. Also, they're historical. We're talking about 70 years ago or whatever, so even further on some of it. So there didn't seem to be any, current implications of the operational pieces to it. It was completely historical. But finally, the two most important things is it is against the law to classify a crime or an embarrassment to the United States government. That cannot happen. Okay. So I knew that my revelation, if the evidence is correct, we're dealing with murder. So you can't classify murder and you can't classify an embarrassment. So I felt comfortable in doing it the way I did, and bringing this out, because either way I was going to have to explain the findings.
And have you had any contact with the you may not be able to answer this. Have you had any contact with either kind of military or government officials after the book has been released?
No. And I guess if anybody showed up, that would be the proof I'm right. But. The point is, I don't think they know. If you read the book and you understand the complexity of the networks, this was a highly compartmentalized operation, okay? What we might say cell-based. In other words, I don't think there's anybody in the United States government right now that knows what's perhaps in these papers simply because it was that close hold.
Well, when you get to... Skorzeny, why, after the war, why wasn't he arrested or put away with a lot of the other war criminals on that side?
Well, he was, he surrendered, and he was taken to a prisoner of war camp. Now, when you read the book and you see the evidence that I present, he did have a very suspicious timeline as far as the way they treat him as a POW. He was very quickly, or not quickly, but he was found not guilty, and the people that showed up for his trial were, at that time, covert operations personnel for the Cold War. So by the 1947 and 48, by 1947, when he went to trial for his violations of military law, he was supported by people who were already working for the CIA or for intelligence services that we had set up for the Cold War. See, there was a transition while Skorzeny was interned. The transition was the war was over. We realized that there was not going to be a Fourth Reich rising from the ashes of the war, and that the real threat, or at least the perceived threat in 1946 and gaining 47 and 48, was the Soviets. They had not demobilized. They were advancing their networks across Eastern Europe, and there was the real high potential that they might springboard from their positions and attack Western Europe. So with that in mind, that is the backdrop for this whole story. Skorzeny and men like him, who were Nazis and had fought for Hitler, they had the experience and network, and the networks that would be of value to us in our new war or confrontation with the Soviets. And the other thing is, we didn't want the Soviets to gain those networks. So that was the real reason Skorzeny became important after the war, is the situation had changed.
Right.
I will also. Oh, go ahead.
Yep.
I'd like to state something about Skorzeny. It's clear. You can look him up online. He fought for Hitler, and he had a number of very illustrious operations for the Third Reich. But I personally interviewed 12 men who knew him in the process of writing this book, men who were military officers, some CIA. And I also read what those some men had written about him that knew him. And to a person, they all said he was not a Nazi. Now, that is not me saying it. That's the people who knew him. And they're saying that he was a highly professional, robotic, if you will, military man. I mean, he was, you gave him a mission, and it was going to get done. I think he was a realist, based on what they told me, that when the war ended, he accepted the fate of history and that the Nazis had lost and moved on. And he was wanting to help the West in its fight against the Soviets. His own family had suffered horribly at the hands of the Soviets. He had personal reasons for retribution. His brother was put in a gulag after the war. So, you know, that's kind of the reason why he was brought in. He was efficient. He was not seen as a diehard Nazi. He had the networks in place that we could utilize. And he got things done. That's exactly the type of person they needed.
So the reality is that Operation Paperclip was the way of the United States getting the scientists and engineers out of Germany to help produce for the U.S. rather than them going to Russia. So this is kind of like the same sort of thing. He wasn't a scientist, but he had ways of getting the job done. And so they wanted him to come over. But so when he came to work for the U.S. against the Russians, how did it turn into something where he was going to be involved in the assassination of a president of that same country?
Yeah, that's a legacy piece that would go further down the line. But when he was first brought in, you know, the CIA, for example, and I talk about the history of the CIA, we just didn't magically have a CIA after the war. We had a number of organizations. First off, our wartime intelligence service, the OSS, was disbanded by executive order. Truman disbanded General Donovan's Office of Strategic Services right after the war. And then shortly thereafter, we realized, we might just need, you know, an intelligence service for dealing with the Soviets. So they reconstituted parts of it, and it underwent a number of name changes, which I go through in the book. And then by 1947, in the same act that created the U.S. Air Force, we created the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency. But even at that point, the agency was split in two. And you had the Office of Policy Coordination and the Office of Special Operations. And the Office of Policy Coordination, although it fell under the CIA, was literally part of the State Department. Well, it was that part. It was the OPC which first brought Skorzeny in as an operational asset. And even then, he was brought in through cutouts, private organizations that were set up to conduct intelligence and operational pieces against the Soviets, particularly in France and Italy and other places. But he was brought in to help with that. That was his initial piece to this. Now, and the former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, said that he said that the Cold War was no Tea Party. Well, we had a lot of problems in the Cold War, especially in the beginning, with very sensitive operations and very lethal operations in Europe, okay? And everything from double agents to elimination of foreign agents, Soviet agents. And that's a whole different ballgame when you get into assassination. But that's what was going on. And the networks that Skorzeny had and the men that he had with him had a lot of expertise in this particular area. I talk about one in particular, the Peter Group, which I go into some detail. So Scorzani's men had experience in assassination. That was also one of the things that Scorzani was called upon to do in the Cold War, was to assassinate targets for both the United States and in particular France. And this developed over the period of the Cold War from the early 1950s all the way up in the 1960s. Now, by the end of the 1950s, when Eisenhower, as president, would expand our assassination operations into something called executive action, which was the targeting of foreign leaders, okay, the elimination of foreign leaders. And the evidence, I would suggest, that I derived from the papers would show that Scorzani was in charge of that particular type of assassination, in other words, executive action. There's evidence for his activity in this capacity in the Congo, and also directed against Fidel Castro under Operation Tropical in Cuba. Now, this occurred only a time before 1963. So when it came time to carry out the assassination of the president, for the reasons I point to in the book, the United States did not have to contract the mafia or come up with some conspiratorial theory, conspiratorial group to direct against the president. We just used an in-house capability. We already had an assassination capability that had been authorized by the president, and President Eisenhower, that is, and that it was housed in the CIA, and that Scorzani was a principal character in that network and directing it. So when it came time to carry out the tragic act in Dallas, we merely issued orders, and again, when I say we, I'm talking about the United States, not anyone I know personally.
Yeah.
But the United States officiaries just issued the order. There's very few people involved here. I mean, they would have issued the order, and it would have been carried out. It was a military operation. It was not a conspiracy in the classical sense. The conspiracy here would be the cover-up, the Warren Commission.
Wow. So what's the biggest or most important point that you want to get out in this book to the public? What is it that you want them to come away with after they read your book?
Well, I think a lot of people have been searching for the truth. I've always been curious about it myself. Here is evidence of a network. Here is evidence of a covert clandestine network with a legacy going back to World War II that's present in Dallas that includes assassination, and that network overlaps into the businesses and people that have been previously written about in JFK assassination histories. So what I want the people to realize is the Warren Commission is a false document, that John F. Kennedy was killed by the United States government, but that act was carried out as part of an official, it was an official act. And it was done to save the country. I talked about this in my section on the motive. And this was not carried out because somebody didn't like him. It wasn't carried out because they wanted some other nefarious reason to do it. They did it because there was a pending catastrophic doom. There was the pending release of information that would have absolutely destroyed the president personally. It would have destroyed the office of the president. It would have brought down the halls of government, and it would have handed the Soviets a high ground moral victory at the height of the Cold War. The only way to stop this information was to perform a coup de grace, a mercy killing. They killed the president to stop the release of the information so that our entire system and he himself would not be destroyed.
Wow.
Ralph, what do you...
Yep, go
sorry.
Ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, mate. Living in the UK for the majority of my life, and clearly focusing more as I grew up on matters that were in the UK rather than the States, My understanding of all the different conspiracies is much less than you guys. But is there any other kind of theory around the assassination of JFK that you would, that knowing about, you think would actually fit quite well with the information that you had if they were both to sit together?
Well, there's a very strong British piece to this in several points, but the most important for motive would be where I direct the reader's attention to the Profumo affair, which you may be familiar with, started in 1961, ran into 1963, where Macmillan, the Harold Macmillan's conservative government, there was a man named John Profumo, who was the Secretary of State for War, was having a sexual relationship with a woman named Christine Keeler. She was a very young 19-year-old model, who was really part of a prostitution ring. She was also the girlfriend of the Soviet naval attaché in London. Well, he was sleeping with her, and it became a major political scandal, and it almost brought down the British government. Well, that network of girls overlapped into a network in the United States that was being run by a man named Bobby Baker. Baker was a political operative Vice President Johnson, and he was running a high-dollar call girl service in Washington, D.C., for a number of politicians, congressmen, senators, and the president. So the two pieces, the Profumo affair and the Bobby Baker scandal, are linked. And President Kennedy was watching the Profumo affair very intently. And it was the breaking news. It was the Bobby Baker scandal, which really started out on concerning illegal vending machines, but was leading to the exposure that the president had been sleeping with prostitutes provided by Bobby Baker. These prostitutes included Ellen Romisch, a West German wife. West German sergeant who was in the United States TDY, and she was sleeping with the president, but there are strong indications that she was also a Soviet agent. So if this is correct, the president, John F. Kennedy, was sleeping with a Soviet agent and other prostitutes being provided by Bobby Baker, and that prostitution ring overlapped into the Profumo ring. This would have been an absolutely devastating revelation. So
how is it that the JFK groups and other authors have they been receptive to your idea and your book?
I do not know. I am not part of the groups that do the research. I know that the historian Dick Russell, who did the foreword, was quite complimentary of my work, and there was others that have seen it. I have not heard anything negative so far. I do intend to make the papers available to the public because it's the papers, the evidence, that hold the key. Again, this is not some idea I developed in my head. I'm merely relating the information derived from the papers, so it will be important for those papers to be viewed by the American public. My intent is to get those papers to an archive, perhaps Duke University, or National Archives, someplace where the public can go in, look at the documents that I looked at, and come to their own conclusions.
It's pretty amazing. Lots of research. How long did it take you to get all this together and get it out into a book?
About 5 years, 3 years extremely intently writing, but about 5 years total from the time I started. I kind of dropped everything I did and worked on this full time.
Ralph, this is, for somebody who is of UK origin, and I'm really hearing from my time on the radio show different kind of conspiracies and different evidence that's being given about the assassination of JFK. And one thing I really want to make our listeners aware of is that an interview never gives kind of the A to Z of the scenario. We dip in and out. We're asking questions because we're interested and we're intrigued on points that you make. But actually, that can be quite confusing for people. So I just want them to get to go out and get this book, because if you read it from A to Z, there's a story behind all of these questions. And I'm sure that you feel the same way.
Yes. In fact, the book as it's written is not a traditional storyline. It is chronological. But in fact, there are several different histories in this book that must be understood, parallel histories, if you will, that are necessary for the reader to understand the Skorzeny network and then how it builds up and goes into Dallas. So these histories serve as a pointer, if you will, to more complex studies that the reader will need to understand. Mm-hmm. I would like to say right up front that if you have in your house a majority of the books written on the JFK assassination, the names in this book will not be in those books. And the story is radically different. And it's based on evidence. That's the reason. This is not regurgitation of anything that's been written before. There are names that are in those other books, but there's a lot of names that are not. And the networks are not in those other books. I'm pointing to absolutely new things that were derived from the papers. Now, the complexity of this book is made somewhat easier by there's two appendices in the book. Appendix A, which is an overall timeline from 1945 to 1963 that explains the development on the interaction of Skorzeny's businesses over time. But then Appendix B focuses directly on Otto Skorzeny's business networks directly into Dallas and how those networks, I think the reader will see that those networks will overlap into the traditional names and activities that have already been previously written about.
Okay, now for the listeners, let's talk about the assassination itself and what you've learned about it from the papers.
Okay, well, I think perhaps the two most important things is the Warren Commission is a cover-up. It was produced to deflect attention away from the operational aspects of the Skorzeny network. Also, Lee Harvey Oswald is a deception. He was manipulated into position by the network. So if you look at Oswald, as far as the Skorzeny papers are concerned, when you look at Oswald, you are looking at the deception. I think he's only mentioned 22 times in my book. You will not get to the answer to the Kennedy assassination by diving any deeper into Lee Harvey Oswald. It will not help you. He was placed into an assassination matrix, and he was utilized as such. He is the deception. Other people that are traditionally involved in the story, and most people are familiar with the name Jack Ruby.
Right.
Jack Ruby is connected to the Skorzeny papers. In fact, he is aware, Jack Ruby was aware of the Skorzeny network prior to his assassination of Oswald. Ruby had a business partner named Thomas Eli Davis, who he was involved with illicit gun trafficking, and Davis is a very important character in the story of the Skorzeny papers. Davis, a business partner of Jack Ruby, met with a man named Victor Oswald, who was business associate of Skorzeny, only weeks before the assassination. So this is the correlation, if you will, between the Skorzeny network and Jack Ruby. And there are other cases of this in the papers where there are key aspects of the assassination. The Texas Book Depository, for example, which was owned by D. Harold Byrd, also linked to the papers, and I explained that linkage. The Zapruder film, the famous Zapruder film, is linked to people within the Skorzeny papers. The Warren Commission member, Alan Dulles, Warren Commission member Alan Dulles was fully aware of the CIA's clandestine use of Otto and Elsa Scorzani in the 1950s. And he was fully aware that Scorzani's network had an assassination capability, a capability, I may add, that was used by the CIA. So, at every turn, the papers indicate that there was a network in Dallas that has not been previously identified and has never been examined.
Do the papers themselves give you a clue of who actually shot Kennedy?
Yes.
Was it Oswald? Or what was it in the paper that you discovered?
Well, I do not go into forensic studies in the paper, but I can tell you this, that there was a French, former French military officer flown out of Dallas, and this is documented by a declassified document. His name is Jean-René Suitre, spelled S-O-U-E-T-R-E, Suitre, I believe is the way it's pronounced. But Captain Suitre, a former French officer who had served in Algeria, was flown out of Dallas within 24 hours of the Kennedy assassination. And that's documented by declassified documents. But the fact of the matter is, Suitre was part of the Scorzani network. Suitre had been a French OAS assassin. The OAS is a French renegade military group that was attempting to kill de Gaulle and for his refusal to keep Algeria French. People are probably familiar with the movie Day of the Jackal.
Right.
Well, Scorzani had recruited for his network and had actually, Scorzani had worked with the OAS and their terror networks in Algeria. That's why the Algerian history is explained in the book. But Captain Suitre was also part of Scorzani's network. So I have no absolute proof, but you have an assassin, a known documented assassin and officer of the OAS who is part of Scorzani's network being flown out of Dallas after the assassination. So I am saying in the book that that is the action arm for the operation. That is the arm. I divide the operation into three pieces, the action arm, the deception arm, which would have been Lee Harvey Oswald, and the support elements, which are doing all the different supporting pieces to make sure it gets done. Everything from logistics to safe houses. But my point here is that Suitre was flown out. My guess is that the shot was taken by either Suitre or a team he commanded.
Now, with all of this information and you putting it out in a book and really kind of getting it out there, are you worried about threats to your own self or some sort of attack against you?
Well, sir, I have not really given that any weight. I think enough time has gone by where the American public can understand this as a history. I'm a soldier. I can't go through life looking over my shoulder like that. By fate, the documents came to me by destiny. I wrote the book, so, you know, I have to just go forward with that. I'm firmly convinced of the findings. Obviously, I can't control everything that's out there.
Right. Wow. Well, Mr. Gannis, this has been amazing. Again, our book that we're talking about is the Scorzani Papers, and it's the evidence for the plot to kill Kennedy, JFK. And our guest has been Major Ralph Gannis. Thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Al. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, Ralph.
Coming up next, Stephen David Lampley delivers his true crime commentary.
Hey, good evening. I want to welcome you to my very first edition of Stephen's Commentary. It's indeed an honor to be with you this evening. Each week we will discuss a mysterious aspect of true crime, forensics, or some related topic. Tonight we're going to talk about just how is it that a police detective knows someone is lying to them. This is going to be part one of a two-part series. I want to start out first by giving you a couple of tidbits about liars and lying. Did you know that in the first 10 minutes of meeting someone new that you will hear 2 to 3 lies? In January, more people lie than any other month. And depending on the circumstances, of course, but if you stay in the bed all day long, this won't apply to you. But the average person can hear up to 200 lies per day. Per day. It's amazing, folks. 200 a day. Before we get started, I need to explain some misinformation that's is out there. One of the biggest misconceptions that I have come across in my many years of law enforcement and general living, is for that matter, is that people will tell me, "Steve, I know how to tell a liar because when I talk to them, if they don't look me in the eyes, then they're lying to me." Folks, listen, if that is what you're using to determine if someone's lying to you or not lying to you, stop it. Please. You're doing yourself and the person you're talking to a gross injustice. Let me tell you something. People who have Asperger's are not usually comfortable looking you in the eye. People who have PTSD may not be comfortable looking you in the eye. Those with low self-esteem or who are shy are not comfortable sometimes looking you in the eye. If you're using the not look at me in the eye indicator that all people are lying to you, quit, please, please. Now, having said that, is not looking someone in their eye an indicator of lying? Yes, of course. But it's not the only tool you have in your basket. If you're using that as the one-size-fits-all indicator to determine if someone's lying to you, you're doing everybody a gross injustice. Detectives use clusters of indicators. The more indicators, the better. All right, now that I've said that, let's move on. Let me tell you something that may amaze you, and I'm being facetious. People lie to police officers. Yeah, I know, right? But how does a detective know when someone's lying to them? Let's use this case in point. Let's say that a detective has brought a suspect in for questioning in a robbery. After some questioning, the detective just point blank asks the individual, "Did you rob the store?" Now let's say that the suspect says, "No, I did not rob the store." And then let's use another scenario where the suspect says, "No, I didn't rob the store." Now, one of those statements indicates a lie. Is that the only thing we use to go by to determine? Of course not. Just like looking at someone in the eye when they talk to you. But it's one indicator. Now, if the suspect said, "No, I did not rob that store," that is an indicator that he or she is lying to the detective. Why is that? Suspects will typically not use words with contractions. It's just one of those things. They typically will not use words with contractions. They will say each word out. They will say, "I did not rob that store," instead of saying, "No, I didn't rob the store." That's just one indicator. Another indicator that police detectives use, is elusion. It's when the suspect is asked a question, but they allude to their innocence. They just don't come right out and say it. They don't come right out and say, "No, I'm innocent," or "I didn't do it." They will allude to their innocence. For instance, if asked, "Did you lock the store this time?" Instead of saying, "Yes, I did not," or "No, I did not lock the store," they will say, "Well, I always lock the store." Well, maybe in the past you did, but we're talking about this time. So what they will do is they will allude to their innocence. All right, another indicator that police detectives will use is eye shift. You're going to have to know whether this person is right-handed or if this person is left-handed. And that's, of course, fairly straightforward and easy to do in an interrogation or interview setting. If the person is right-handed and they look upper right after being asked a question, That is an indicator that that person is trying to concoct a story where a story previously did not exist. In other words, a lie. They're trying to create a story for the question. If the person is right-handed and looks upward left, that is an indicator that they are trying to remember a situation that did occur, or the truth. Now, just the opposite is true for someone who is left-handed. If you have a suspect who is left-handed, he or she looks upper left, that is an indicator that they are trying to concoct a story where one previously did not exist, just like the right-handed person looked upper right. If the left-handed person looks upper right, that indicates that they are trying to remember a situation that did occur, or the truth. Now, again, I can't emphasize this enough. Is that the only indicator, and is that alone enough to decide that a person is lying? No, not at all. By all means, no. But there are indicators. Now, these are just a couple of the indicators that we will discuss, and we'll discuss more next week and go into more detail about a couple other indicators that you can use or that investigators use to determine if someone's lying. I would like to thank you for your time. I would also like to urge you to invite others to listen in to the House of Mystery radio show each week. My name is Stephen Lampley. I'm glad to be here, glad to be your host, and glad to spend time with you. You have a great evening.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.